call to order the Education Subcommittee of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Today is Wednesday, March 26, 2003, and we are here for the continuance of our public hearing on House Bill 5016. And before I open that public hearing, we have here a bundle of CDs that the Department of Education has made available to us. And on this CD is the spreadsheet that I was referencing yesterday that allows you to build your own quality ed model. And so if you're interested in having one of these, please feel free to take them. I think we have enough to give one to about every person in the legislative body. But that is available. It's a very powerful tool, and it's a very interesting look to get. I'm going to, at this point, open the public hearing on House Bill 5016, which is the state school fund within the Department of Education. We have with us today some people that I will allow to give public testimony first thing. And so if you would be so kind as to come forward and introduce yourselves for the record.
I'm Sam Colby.
What's your name?
Aaron.
Okay, you need to probably pull the mic close to you.
Okay.
My name is Aaron.
Thank you for coming here today. We appreciate you coming forward, and we appreciate the courage that you have to do this.
Thank you. I think all people should get a good education, because if the whole world didn't, then nobody would know anything. All people should have a good future by learning things at school, like some math and some art and reading books. What would happen if nobody learned math? People would pay more than $1,000 for shoes and be poor. They will ask, how much should I pay you? Nobody would know the answer.
Okay.
If people don't know math, then they might lose all their money. What would it be like if you could not read books, happy birthday on a cake, or letters? I would not know what Singh said. I'm glad that I can go to school. If I were only the person who did not learn how to read, I would feel bad and other kids would make fun of me. I learned things from my teacher. Other things to learn are science and being safe. If people did not respect each other, then this will be a bad world. I'm glad I live in United States of America and I go to school. Thank you. Okay. I like Teddy Kulongoski. He's my friend. I want you to support education. Children like me have dreamed to become governor someday. Let's work with Teddy to support education.
Thank you very much. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself? How old are you?
I'm 7.
And what grade are you in?
Second grade.
And what school do you go to?
Innerville.
And who's your teacher?
Mrs. Taylor.
She's a very good teacher. She's taught you a lot of things. You must be very proud of all the things that you know, and you must be very proud of your self-confidence, too. You did an excellent job in your testimony. I noticed that you brought a couple of animals into the hearing room.
Yeah.
Can you tell us about your animals?
We're making a piñata for a birthday.
Are you going to have this at your birthday?
Mm-hmm.
What are you going to put inside of it?
It already have candy in it.
When's your birthday?
July 14th.
You have to wait till July before you can get to the candy inside the piñata?
Yeah.
I admire your self-control. Are there any questions or comments from the members of the committee?
I just would like to comment. You did an excellent job, and you pronounced Kulongoski better than most people do. So I want to commend you. So.
You don't want to see his picture with the governor?
Well, I see him on the in the drawing here.
Yes, it's a picture of the governor.
Ah.
Ah.
Tell them.
Thank you very, very much for coming here today and giving us this public testimony. We very much enjoyed hearing from your son, and he is very articulate.
Thank you, Chair. And they are distinctive senators and representatives. We are happy to be here. We are happy to support education. And he really enjoyed the opportunity. Thank you very much for giving me the time.
Don't forget your dog. back to our regular agenda. That was a very nice break from the usual there. Today we have a report on the audits that are available to us, and so the chair will call David Dean from the Audits Division forward, and we will talk about the Secretary of State's audit that was presented to the Audit Committee over the interim.
Thank you. Madam Chair, what an act to follow. I don't know if I can do it justice.
Yes. We have education experts here, so.
Did you bring in the Arts and Crafts Project?
Close. We have an audit report for you. For the record, I'm Kathy Polino, Director of the Secretary of State Audits Division, and with me is David Dean. He's an audit administrator, and he's responsible for our current education audit work. What we were hoping to do for you today is just give you an idea of the kinds of information that we have available to you as you start to make a lot of your policy decisions. We hope this information will be helpful. We did present this audit report. Chair Morgan is on the Joint Legislative Audit Committee, so it'll be a little bit of a repeat for you. But we'll go ahead and give you an update on this report and then let you know also the current work that we have in process. So with that, David.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is David Dean, and I'm an audit administrator with the Secretary of State's Audits Division. And this morning, I have a brief presentation for you with two purposes. First, I'd like to recap for the committee some of the key results from our December report on K-12 spending. And then second, I'd like to describe for you the audit work that we're currently doing in this area. Our December audit report provides a snapshot of statewide spending on K-12 in Oregon. And it provides some perspective based on national averages and spending patterns in individual school districts. What we found was Oregon spends somewhat more on K-12 education than other states, mostly due to higher than average costs for support services. And we also noted in that report that costs in very small school districts are significantly higher than costs in larger districts. With that overview, let me draw your attention to a few of the figures and tables in our report. Tables 1, 2, and 3 summarize K-12 spending in three broad categories: instruction, support services, and non-instruction. And these spending categories were developed by the National Center for Education Statistics for use in all states. And as you can see, Oregon spent about $4,244 per student on instruction, $2,653 on support services, and $251 on non-instruction services during the 1999-2000 school year. So that brings Oregon's total per pupil spending that year average $7,149. And then comparing those figures with other states, Oregon spends about $24 less on instruction, $307 more on support services, and $42 less on non-instruction activities. Altogether, Oregon's K-12 spending was $241 more than the national per pupil average of $6,908. And if you're trying to follow along in the report, at this point I'd like to draw your attention to the figures that begin on page 6. And these figures summarize our analysis of spending patterns among 197 Oregon school districts. One observation that you may have concerns the higher than average spending by very small school districts. For example, figure 2 and table 7 show that instruction spending for very small school districts with less than 500 students averaged $5,563 per pupil. And that amount was about $1,000 more per student than the comparable amount for larger school districts. And similarly, if you look at figures 3 and table 9, they show that small districts have significantly higher costs for support services as well. Also, I'll mention that we've included summary level information on K-12 spending by all 197 school districts that we reviewed in our appendices A and B. And finally, I want to let you know that we sent the Department a management letter, which included more detailed information on the individual spending by the individual school districts. And we've also posted that information on our website. And this morning I gave you a handout, so that information is available and it's downloadable on our website. Before I conclude, I just wanted to describe the work that we're currently doing with the Department of Education. And first, I'll mention that we're doing a follow-up to this December report. And as I just mentioned, we concluded in that report that Oregon spends more on K-12 education than other states, mostly due to higher than average costs for support services. So for our current audit, we want to dig a little deeper and find out what's driving spending for support services. And we plan to examine school district spending patterns to see if there may be opportunities for cost savings in this area. And our intent is for this analysis to provide enough detailed information so that decision makers will have an opportunity to more strategically consider their spending decision in high-cost areas. And finally, just one last comment about a third project that we're working on. This last project is looking at programs for special education and English language learners. And this is a preliminary look at risks, and it could lead to additional audit work in these areas. And that concludes my presentation. I just want to thank you for your interest in our audits. And if you have any questions, Kathy and I would be happy to respond.
One of the areas we have kind of been zeroing in the K-12 arena on some of the issues that are cost increase drivers. And you've mentioned some of them, being English as a second language and special education. We've also had discussions about the public employees' retirement system and the cost of medical coverage for the employees within the system. Can you talk to us with relevance to PERS and medical health insurance, what you're finding and the direction that you're moving in?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'd refer you to the tables at the beginning of the audit report, and specifically if you take a look at Table 2 on page 3.
Give us time to find this.
Sure. Right.
Okay.
So what Table 2 is showing you is the spending on support services. And so I've said that a couple times this morning. That really seems to be where Oregon is out of line with spending in other states. So if you look at this last column on the right, that's a projection of the fiscal impact of these various cost areas. So overall, that bottom line figure of $167 million. So what that means is if Oregon had spent the equivalent of the average amount in other states, then this amount of money would have been available to be spent someplace else. So what we are working on now in this current audit is to look at, okay, in this broad area of support services, this table shows you some smaller subcategories within there. So you can see student support, instructional staff support. And what we want to do is we want to follow up on the ones that seem to have the most promise, seem to be the most different from average. So, for example, if you scan down that list, you get about two-thirds of the way down to the business and other support services. You can see that Oregon's average was $411, and the national average was $215. And so that was, $200 more. And when you multiply that times about 550,000 students in our system, that impact is $106 million. And what we want to do now is dig into those categories. And your question had to do with what's inside that. So we need to really kind of unravel that. The student support, that's one of the big categories there, $47 million impact. School level administration, that's one of the big ones with a $34 million impact. And those two categories specifically are driven mostly by salaries and benefit costs. The business and other support services isn't driven as much by personnel costs. So what we're going to do in this current audit is get in there and look at these cost categories that seem to really be driving our spending on support services and trying to understand why is that. I would caution we don't presume that because somebody a district is high that is unwarranted, but we'd like to know more why is this happening, and we hope that there are lessons that one district can learn from another.
One moment. Ms. McGlashan, do you have a clarification question?
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I was just wondering, in regards to your question, I thought you were asking about things like health insurance costs and PERS particularly, and I was wondering if perhaps you could discuss in Table 1 those first two items where salaries are about $192 million less and benefits $130 million more, and maybe that would more shed more light on the issue and answer the chair's
Representative
question.
Bates, do you want to inject your question now?
I really want to make a comment. my beaver is driving me crazy. If you look at this from a little different point of view, you may have a different attitude towards what this audit is telling us. If I was coming from the state of let's pick a state that I've been to before and know they've got problems. Let's say Missouri with an educational system. I'd say, gee, Oregon spends less on average than the national average does. It's not slightly less, not much. $13 million out of a $5 billion budget really isn't anything significant. They must be doing something different out there, because while they spend the same or less on average than the U.S. does nationally, they have the best system in the country almost any way you measure it as far as outcomes are concerned. And I'd be looking inside this budget to say, what does Oregon do different that other states don't do to produce such a wonderful product? And I have a sense that we're looking out in the wrong direction. We're looking into this odd saying, what are we doing wrong? What we should be thinking is, what are we doing right? And what seems to be working in the state that other states don't seem to be able to get a hold of? And that's the information we should be sharing. And the sense I get from people is that's the opposite of what we're talking about here. We're looking at a system that, any way you want to measure it externally, seems to do an excellent job compared to the rest of the country. Maybe not internationally, but to compare to the rest of the country. And I get the sense that people think there's something wrong. We should be looking for what's right. And those support services may be the key. We may have decided that counselors, student health centers, are more effective in getting a better product out than just putting more teachers into a classroom. And that's, I want to bring that out as a point as we go through these audits, that we're not looking what is wrong. We might be looking for what's right and trying to spread that further. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Well, I respect your comment, Representative Bates, but I think that the purpose of auditing is to try to figure out what the norm is, and then what you're looking at, how it differs from the norm, and then get further and further into that so that you can make the judgments that you're talking about making. That I would submit to you that this is an attempt to find out where the state differs from the norm and then discuss why that is and the wisdom of that.
I agree with that, Madam Chair, but the sense I've gotten this building when I hear about these audits is not that. Okay, but since I get it, something's wrong. And that's pretty widespread, and I want to deal with that right now.
Okay. I appreciate that.
Madam Chair?
Senator Mesmer.
I'd like to follow up on that a little bit. Would it be possible, I'm looking at page 12 and 13, would it be possible to tie those expenditure percentages to the grading or the ranking of our districts on how they rate, and I think that would tie this together. more closely if there is a relationship there or not. And I also, I'm just puzzled. Some of the districts have zero expenditures for non-instruction. How do they do that? It would tend for me to believe that they're not counting the figures in the right column or something. I would think they'd all have to have some non-instruction.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the first point regarding the focus of the audit, I would respond by saying what we've tried to do with these audits is keep the focus narrow enough that we can contribute to the conversation. And we deliberately have excluded looking at linking expenditures and any kind of results. So we're strictly giving you feedback on expenditures by school districts and how that compares. And we hope that adds to the mix of information that you have to consider. I think it certainly would be possible at some point in the future to provide, you know, parallel information about results. That information is available from other sources. The department is tracking that. And ultimately, I'm sure those are the kinds of things you want to consider, not just what the costs were, but what the results were. And I want to reassure you that we don't presume fault or something, you know, a bad thing. We're just trying to provide information, sort this data out in a way that people can consider what it means. I think one of the values we see here is the ability of this information to provide some benchmarks. In the past, before we had this data available, which is this data that we're using is from the DBI system, which has just been around for a couple of years, it was difficult for a district to know how they were doing compared to one another. And likewise, it was difficult for, you know, Oregon officials to know, well, gee, how are we doing compared to officials in other states? So that's kind of the basic purpose behind the audits.
If I could just interject, too, I think that one of the issues that we have had as long as I've been in this building is how does the money get spent? Once we bail it up and push it through the front door of the Capitol, what happens to it? And I really appreciate being able to have this information so that we can try to answer that question.
Madam Chair, one more point on that, too. One of the big things that we were trying to get out of this was not to, again, do a good or bad between districts, because, you know, there are higher costs in smaller districts, but that may not necessarily be a bad thing. What we were hoping to do with this is to be able to provide information so you know what kinds of questions to start asking. You know, where are you going to start asking questions about how the money is being spent, what it's going for. Wanted to make one other quick point in response to Representative Bates. One of the other things that we're trying to do with this second part of the study is look for some of those best practices that are out there. We know that there's got to be some innovative practices that districts have come up with to deal with the shortfalls. And what we're hoping to do is try to capture some information on what are some of those best practices, what can we learn from the good and the ones that are doing not so good, and help to share that information across districts, because there's got to be good stuff out there. So that's our hope out of this.
Senator Gordley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If we want to know what happens to the money at the district level, then shouldn't we be requiring district audits, which is something we fall short of?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, all of the school districts do get a financial statement opinion audit done, and that information all comes to our office. We oversee the municipal audit program for the state. We have actually two auditors that oversee and set the standards by which the audits are to be conducted, and then they go out and do desk reviews of, and then actual visits to the CPA firms doing the work. The school districts contract with the CPA firms for the audits, and then they file them with us. So a financial statement audit is being done at all the school districts. If you talk about other audit work, looking at performance indicators and performance audits, that is up to the individual school district right now to decide what to do.
And I would submit, Senator Gordley, that one of the questions that ultimately the legislature is going to have to deal with is the fact that we have a system of handing out money that doesn't have an accountability piece that goes along with it. and that we've got a kind of a pre-measure 50 accountability structure and a very different funding structure.
I don't disagree with the point that you're making. I do have another question that will aid my understanding of how administration is defined. When I look at the business and other support services category, it appears that there are items included that would that could fall under the administrative category. For example, business support services, the payroll, purchasing, printing. Why is that not administration separate from those other support services that we see in the list here? Research, development, evaluation. Where's the line drawn? And how's the line drawn?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, these are definitions that started out at the national level with the National Center for Education Statistics. And then when Oregon developed their database initiative project, they tried to categorize the expenses that school districts would report in that would be consistent with that national system. So the definitions, you know, started out nationally. We have defined those at the state level. And so it's up to the individual school districts to take a look at those definitions and then take their accounting information and report in that standard way. So I don't know that I can explain necessarily the rationale for why it was done that way. I can tell you, how they do it generally, and that's the explanation that I would have. I hope that was responsive.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, on page 5, there's also a description of the categories themselves and a little more detail of what goes into each category. And Oregon, just a couple years ago, put together what's called a uniform chart of accounts so that because all school districts were reporting their expenditure information in different categories. And so to provide some uniformity so that you could look across district lines, they put together a uniform chart of accounts, and now all school districts are reporting under that model. And that's one of the things that the local CPA firms look at as they're doing their financial statement audits is making sure that everything's recorded according to that chart of accounts.
I have a question that I have a need to clarify the field here for my own mind. You've got kind of a structure of the Department of Education, the ESDs, the school districts that administer, and then the schools that are underneath of those districts. The numbers that we're looking at here, which part of that applies? Which part of that is involved in these numbers?
Madam Chair, all of the spending. We included all of the spending at the state level.
So this
and
goes
what
from
we,
the department clear down to the school?
With the exception of the department. All of the spending by school districts. And with regard to the ESDs, we took those expenditures and we allocated those out to those expenses. The money they spend at the ESD, we allocated that back to the school district. So when we report on how the money was spent, that includes money that was spent by the ESD for the benefit of a particular school district. So if an ESD was providing services to several different school districts, then the money would show up in our report as if the school district itself had spent the money.
So just to reiterate then, is it a true statement to say that the scope of this audit will reflect spending at the ESDs, at the school districts, and in the schools?
Madam Chair, that's correct.
So when you do your breakout on business and other support services, are you going to break out where that spending takes place, or are you just going to attribute it all to a district?
Madam Chair, we would... Our proposal, our thought is that we'll analyze that spending by the districts, and then we'll do some comparison within these size categories. So it would be unfair to compare, a school district with 50 kids to a school district with 50,000 kids. So we're going to do our analysis based on the size of those school districts. But what we'll be doing is looking at school district spending.
Okay. So are you going to be doing, when as you get down in the detail, are you going to be doing samples, or are you doing every district?
Madam Chair, we'll be taking a sample. And how that'll work is perhaps if you take a look in Appendix B and page 15, maybe this would be an illustration. What this is showing is spending for instruction by small school districts, school districts with 500 or fewer students. And the number that I talked to you about earlier in my overview was, you can see 57% on average. That was the amount of the percentage of all of their expenditures on instruction. But if you look at this this chart, you can see there was quite a variation. So there were some districts that got as much as 83% of all of their spending on instruction, and other districts where it was as low as 31%. So our sampling is going to really be based on outliers. So we're going to look at districts for these individual expenditure categories where we can see where someone was particularly high and particularly low. And then you see some interesting things where two districts will be about the same size. They may be neighboring districts, and yet the spending pattern looks real different. So we think that if we select those districts based on that look interesting, just based on how their spending is distributed, that we'll be able to learn. So in other words, we're looking for these best practices. Why did one, why is one district able to, you know, achieve a much lower or higher spending pattern than another? You know, was there a some decision that one district made that the other could learn from, or vice versa? Or it may be that there's very good reasons why somebody's spending is very low or very high. And I think those will be evident as we get in and we ask about the details. So we're going to have conversations with individual school districts. We anticipate doing audit work with doing some kind of a survey with probably about 50 districts. That would be about 1 in 4 of the Oregon school districts during this current audit.
What kind of a time frame are you on to do this second layer?
Madam Chair, we're just wrapping up our planning for it right now, and then we'll go on to our field work, and that usually takes 6 or 8 weeks for us to actually go out and get the data. That's going to put us April, May. So we're looking at a reporting time of some, probably about June. Hopefully by the end of June we'll have wrapped this up and have a report for you.
And what is the burden that will fall on the districts that are selected to be the sample districts?
Madam Chair, we're hoping that the burden it won't be terribly burdensome. So what we're going to do is we're going to do some survey work, and depending on the technology that each of these districts have, it may involve, you know, talking to people on the telephone. It may involve some faxing some questions back and forth. It may involve, you know, email. But we're hoping that that we are able to just be fairly non-intrusive. You know, a back and forth, a few phone calls, you know, some documents, you know, through the internet, and we think that that will be the extent of what's required of the individual school districts.
So just to clarify then, what we're going to end up with in 4 or 5 months or so is going to be a breakout of a sampling of districts within each of the size categories that you have, and a precise breakdown of only the business and support services category and how the money is actually spent there?
Well, I think what we're envisioning, Madam Chair, is something like what we've given you here, where table 1, 2, and 3 are these big cost buckets, and now we've isolated one of those buckets as something that's driving the overall spending pattern. It looks unusual. So then this next layer, we're going to look at that one bucket of support services and then look at the cost drivers there. So we'll have some specific information for you on the big areas. Student support, you can see that's a big area. School level administration, that's a big area that seems to be driving support services. Business and other support services, that's a big area. We'll concentrate our efforts there. And we'll have roll-up data, you know, the big picture, and then we'll also provide the more detailed information like we have given you with the attachment. You know, for your purposes, you may not be particularly interested in all the details. You may more want the kind of roll-up, higher-level analysis, but we're going to have both available. We anticipate that school districts are going to have more detailed questions about how they're spending.
Work with the uniform chart of accounts that go across all the districts?
Chair, yes, that's right. That's the basis for all of this analysis. It's the data that the school districts are reporting in there.
Senator Gordon.
Thank you. To help me further understand the approach that you're going to be using, I did take a look at the definitions that start on page 5, and I noticed that on page 6 that the department staff, I'm just reading from the report, department staff felt that two support service subcategories, student support services and instructional staff support services, would have been better classified as instructional support services because they represent direct services to students closely related to classroom instruction, such as special education, counseling, library, and media services. And then it goes on to say, for the purposes of the review, you follow the NCES definition. In this next layer of looking at the detail, will you get at the approach that the department staff advised you to follow so that we get down to that level of detail that tells us what is the actual spending for students and what's the actual and instruction? You follow the
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, we will provide that level of detail. We'll provide probably more detail than anyone wants to look at. The comment that we included in our report that you just read, really, it wasn't a disagreement on the spending in any way. It was really the department feeling that, would be better if those two categories were reported as instruction spending, not support service spending. And they didn't disagree on the numbers. They just thought, well, we should move it over in this column. And we chose to use the national definitions because we had there'd been a lot of thought put into it that way. Other states were using it, and for comparison purposes, we thought it was most appropriate to just stick with those definitions. But we will give you plenty of detail.
Representative March.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Dean, I'm kind of looking on the instructional side here, and I know a lot of times, we've been talking about the benefits part of this, PERS, health insurance, et cetera. But don't most of the districts look at salaries and benefits sort of as a package and contract that way? That because if you add those two together, I see we're actually spending $62 million less than the national average. So,
Madam Chair, Representative March, I think you're right that folks do kind of think of that as a package. And, you know, we observed the same thing. You know, Oregon's spending on salaries for instruction were significantly less than the national average, you know, $3,000 per student less. On the other hand, benefit spending here in Oregon was somewhat higher, $238 more than the average. But when you look at those as a package, as you're suggesting, they do more or less cancel themselves out.
And, Madam Chair, one other point on that is that these numbers here in this report are looking at a per-student average, not necessarily a per-instructor. So as far as where we're at in comparison to the national average, that's a whole different ball game on salary levels. Does that make sense?
Right. Okay. Right. Thanks.
Representative Bates.
Madam Chair, the next part of your audit sounds extremely intriguing because you may be getting down to what really differentiates school districts and Oregon from other parts of the country. I would ask first, looking at some of these figures you've got here, the difference amongst districts is really pretty dramatic. Do you think there's any confusion amongst the districts in the reporting to you, or do you think this is pretty real for what you were trying to get to?
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, we did do some checking on the numbers, and I want to just kind of reiterate what Kathy said a moment ago. The data that's going into that DBI system is data that the school districts are reporting on their financial reports. So the independent auditors who the districts hire have already had a chance to look at that to see if the school districts were and test the data to see if the data looks right. And they're passing on it. We do another level of review on that, and that's looking good. We audited the financial that DBI system several years ago, 2 or 3 years ago, and our audit found that the data was reliable. We did a little more testing for this audit, and it was looking reasonably solid. Now, that's not to say that there aren't mistakes. I think, you know, no data is perfect, and I think as we get down and look at these differences, we may well discover that one district is interpreting a definition in a little different way than another district. As a matter of fact, I think we know a few of those instances already, and we'll point that out where it's significant. But I think overall, to answer your question, the data is looking reasonably solid.
The next question I'd have then is, it would be, I don't know if you could, this is within the realm of your audit or something you could do, when you find these differences between districts, and obviously if the data is good, you're probably going to, can we relate that to student outcomes in those different districts? I mean, does the way the audit shows people are spending money differently in one district than another produce a better result or a worse result? Now, that would be interesting information if you have a way of maybe looking at 3rd, 5th, 8th, 10th grade testing and see how that's comparing to the pattern of spending in different districts. Is that something within the realm of the audit, or is that beyond what you're planning to do?
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, that is beyond where we're at right now. The only reason being that there are so many variables that impact it, rather than just spending, we would need to look a little bit broader than just tying direct dollars into outcomes. We've thought about it, and we think that's a good kind of logical next step of where to go. But there are a lot more considerations than what we would be able to do within the scope of this. Again, we're trying to keep that scope down so we can get some good information out again. But there are statistical ways to start tying some of this information together and seeing, you know, if there is correlations between expenditure patterns and outcomes. So
I would be very much in favor of a big note of caution here about trying to correlate spending in one area of budgets to student success or failure. I think that we have to bear in mind that this is an extremely dynamic system and that one piece of it doesn't make or break it in terms of student success. Did you have a follow-up?
No, I didn't. Sure. Thank you.
I like killed the discussion. Sue McGlashan, sorry. LFO.
Oh, I just wanted to add, Madam Chair and members of the subcommittee, that I believe this next biennium, one of the things that the department wants to do is start looking at tying the funding to the outcomes. So just so you know, they're looking at that also.
And I think that the other strength that we have here is with the database that the department is developing, that as we get a deeper pool of data, we are going to be able to have more factors to use in the analysis and the correlation to student success. That this is kind of equivalent to flailing upstream in the dark here. Representative March.
Well, I just want to comment as a former auditor myself. I appreciate the work here. It's very, very fascinating. I think it's gives us a good overview of where we stand in with the national numbers, and some ideas of where to go. In your next cut, I assume you're also going to work in the ESDs into that picture. So that'll be also interesting. And I was wondering, you know, maybe that might be one of the areas where our research, development, et cetera, maybe pops in. But, you know, thank you for your work on this. It's really good.
I would concur with Representative March's comments. I think from the point of view that we view this in terms of making policy decisions, that it would be very helpful for us to have a breakout in the numbers between what is spent at the administrative level, what's spent at the PSD level, and what's spent in the schools. Any further questions, comments, parting shots, words of wisdom?
Madam Chair.
Just a question.
Just in the interest of, you know,
full disclosure.
Full disclosure. One of the results from this audit report apparently was one of the conclusions was that the size of the school district appears to influence district spending. And you might recall on Monday when we went over the background for this hearing that I mentioned there's a report that was done by the Department of Education in October of 2002 is when it was issued on the cost of operating small schools in Oregon. And if any of you are interested in that, I can certainly get you a copy.
And I think that would be good to distribute that to the members of the committee and those of us that represent legislative districts that have small districts in them, small schools. Clearly recognize the challenges that those people face in terms of fixed cost and it's much different spreading of costs over ADMWs in a small district than a large district.
Madam Chair, I guess since I got fried this morning on an issue on the Chamber of Ashland and Medford on one of our good representatives suggesting that we consolidate all the school districts in the Rogue Valley. I can point out it wasn't my bill. do you have any information indicating if there really is cost savings if you take districts of 2,000 or 3,000 and bring them into consolidation of 10,000 or 15,000? Is there any indication that really is a cost saving? Local people in Rogue Valley are not really happy about this right now.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Bates, we don't have any of that information ourselves. One thing that may be interesting to look at, though, is that there has been a consolidation a couple years back from X number of schools down to
right.
Where we're at today. I don't know if there's information there to learn from, but I'm sure there is studies out there on what the cost savings were associated with that.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Your Senator Messerschmidt.
I'm intrigued by that results of your audit in that category, simply because let me point out that Portland, and I notice on your graph, when they get to certain size, the efficiency seems to go the other way a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And when we look at the Portland School District, I know that's being discussed at this point. I'm also familiar in my Senate district, Lincoln County, which has struggled for years. The demographics, the communities, I don't know what's going on there, but I know that district years ago when I served on a school board in Coquille. It was well known that the Lincoln County School District just was struggling. And so they've combined the whole county into one school district, and due to geography or whatever, it just has never seemed to work very well. So it'd be interesting if, I don't know if you can do that through the audit or the Department of Education can kind of play with that and try to figure out why some consolidations seem to work quite well and others just have not worked well at all.
Chopping at the bit back there.
And I think that is a separate issue than the one that we're trying to get to today. And what I want to do in the interest of time is keep working on these audits and putting that information forward. I would urge you to get together with Mr. Rose and have a discussion on that issue. And perhaps it's an issue that we could address in the public hearings that we're going to have tonight and tomorrow morning. Yes. I was hoping that you would. Any further comments or questions on the Secretary of State's audit? Thank you very much. We really appreciate you sharing your time with us. And the next audit that we're going to deal with is an audit that has been brought forward by OSBA, done by Econ Northwest. And what I would ask is John Marshall to come forward and please introduce.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, good morning. John Marshall representing the Oregon School Boards Association. I appreciate the opportunity to present to you the results of our study on K-12 spending. We commissioned this study out of a level of frustration. It seems like every time some national report would be released, the Oregonian would publish Oregon school spending data, how it compared with other states, and each of those studies seemed to suggest different numbers, different rankings for Oregon, and so forth. And our members, of course, were asking, why are these numbers so different? So we commissioned Eco Northwest, which is a Portland-based, very reputable economic consulting firm, to try to answer essentially three questions. The first question was, how does Oregon really compare with other states, and why is the data that we see published so different? The second question we wanted to answer is to look at Oregon school spending in Oregon specifically over time and see how it's changed. And finally, we wanted to take a look at what we selected 16 school districts to do specific case studies. And what we hope those case studies would show is to put a human face on the differences and the changes that have occurred over the last decade in light of school funding equalization and so forth. So with me is John Taponia, the economist from Eco Northwest, who presented that study, and with your permission, I'll allow him to proceed.
Welcome.
Thank you. Again, my name is John Taponia. I'm a managing director with Eco Northwest. I'm in our Portland office. And as John mentioned, we started working on this report about a year ago. It was inspired, I think, in part by an article that appeared in the Oregonian in the spring of 2002 that looked at the same data that the Secretary of State was discussing that showed that Oregon's average spending per student was in the $7,300 per student area. And basically led to a lot of confusion, I think, both among people who were engaged in the school funding debate here in Salem, but then throughout the state as well, because there are a lot of different ways to calculate spending per student. So certainly one of the goals of this was to clarify and to look at all of the different ways of calculating that and to see how it has changed over time. I'm going to be working through this handout. We also have the report, which I understand you have. If you have any detailed questions about the report, we can turn to that as well. John mentioned the three study questions, which are on page two of that handout. I'll just reiterate them. Spending per student in Oregon, how is it calculated and how has it changed over time? And the second one, how does Oregon's spending per student compare with that of other states and with the national average? That analysis is almost identical to the analysis done by the Secretary of State's audit, and so I'll spend a little bit less time on that one. Basically, the findings using the same database and very similar conclusions. And then finally, how has the spending per student changed for 16 school districts?
Yep. Just for a moment, Representative Bates has a line of question that he wants to pursue.
Yeah, I'm just going to show some huge ignorance here.
Okay.
And I hope you take this question in the right vein.
Okay.
thank you for coming and presenting. I'd just like to know what your background is and where you guys come from and what you've done for other areas. I'm just ignorant of your organization.
Of our organization? Okay. We are a Eco Northwest was founded in 1974 by Ed Whitelaw. He's a professor of economics at the University of Oregon. We have been doing economic, finance, and planning analyses first in Oregon, then in Washington, and increasingly across the United States since 1974. We have offices in Eugene, Portland, and Seattle. Personally, I worked in Eco Northwest in the late 1980s after having graduated from the University of Oregon. I have a graduate degree from the Harvard School of Public Policy. Worked for the U.S. Congressional Budget Office in the 1990s, and then joined Eco Northwest again in 1997 as a managing director, and have done a number of studies on a wide range of public policy issues, including economic impacts of the Oregon University system on their local economies, economic impacts of Intel on the Washington County economy, a wide range of economic and financial statistical studies.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A follow-up question. What kind of clients? Do you have clients you serve or something? You have state agencies?
Yeah, we are a for-profit, we're a for-profit economic consulting firm. We have a fair share of our business is providing economic testimony in litigation matters. So we have some of my partners actually testify in court cases. We've testified, for example, in the Exxon Valdez court case on the impacts of that oil spill on local municipalities in Alaska. We testified last year in San Francisco on the cost benefit of a gasoline additive, MTBE, that has caused groundwater impacts and air impacts, et cetera. In addition to that litigation work, we also work for public and private clients.
Examples?
Well, I do work personally for the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, helping them on welfare and child support enforcement issues, which was an expertise of mine at the U.S. Congressional Budget Office. We actually forecasted the PERS unfunded liability for PERS. Built a model that looked forward and projected a number of different retirement scenarios and stock market outcomes. One of my partners, Randy Pasdina, sits on the governor's PERS commission. He was also chair of the Oregon Investment Council for some time. Ed Whitelaw, our president, has sat on the Oregon Progress Board for a number of years.
I'd love to know what you use your PERS expectation, but that's a different story. Do you have private clients you use, corporations? Or?
Yes. Again, through our litigation matters, we serve a large number of private clients. We have Weyerhaeuser, for example, as a client, Louisiana Pacific. Trying to think of other, we do a fair amount of work for local housing developers that are interested in market analyses of things of that nature.
Nonprofits, unions.
Nonprofits, unions. Yes, we did. We've done work for nonprofits throughout the United States. Children First for Oregon has been a client. Oregon Center for Public Policy has been a client. Institute for Wisconsin's Future.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to get a feel if you have a broad range and if you represent all parties, and I appreciate it.
We certainly do. I believe we have two of our better-known principals, Randy Pasdina and Ed Whitelaw, our president, come from slightly different ends of the political spectrum. And so you will find Echo Northwest, in order to stay in business and stay in business for a long time, has to produce objective reports. If we produce a report that is appears not to be objective, I don't think that we would stay in business very long if we were perceived as sort of analysts for hire.
Madam Chair, thank you for indulging me. I'm just completely ignorant of this, and thank you for your education. Mm-hmm. Appreciate your comments.
And Madam
thank
Chair,
you.
I might add that this is the second study that was produced for us by Echo Northwest. The first was an analysis of the impact of K-12 spending on local economies that was issued last summer as well.
Thank you.
Mr. DePagna, after that grilling, would you please...
Did you want to hear about me too?
No.
We know
I'm actually
you.
Trying to... I can't get myself out of this, can I? Thank you.
All right.
I think you better go drink some more herbal tea or something.
So, again, to move to the first or our answers on this first question on page 3 there, spending per student, how is it calculated and how has it changed? If you go to page 4, obviously, a spending per student is going to have a numerator and a denominator. And the numerators are different spending or revenue definitions. And so this chart on page 4 gives you sort of a thumbnail sketch of what you could put in the numerator in terms of spending or revenues. And so the first and sort of smallest of those numerators would be the formula operating revenues, and those are the monies that you as a legislature distribute to districts throughout the state that are comprised in essence of state general revenue monies from income taxes and the like, but then also incorporate local property tax revenues as well. If you add to that grant programs that are generated monies from the state, federal, and local level, and child nutrition programs that are not part of that formula operating revenue, then you get to a definition that I would call current expenditures, or that is known nationally as current expenditures. And that is a concept that is sort of the ongoing operation and maintenance of the schools, but all of the operations and maintenance of the schools that are taking place at the schools. And then if you add to the current expenditures major capital outlays and debt service on interest, then you'd get to a notion of total expenditures. So if you're thinking about how much are we spending on either remodeling schools or expanding schools or building new schools, et cetera, then you'd get up to this concept of total expenditures.
Let me interject with a question here. Mm-hmm. Local revenue that is outside of the local dollars that go into the formula that form the local
correct
piece, how did you get your arms around what that local inflow of dollars is that's outside of the formula?
The Department of Education keeps track of those figures. They certainly know of the revenues that are counted in the formula operating revenues, but then there are other categories, local school option, for example, foundation monies, et cetera, that they keep track through sort of their very precise accounting that do not go into the formula operating revenues. So those are through accounting and accurate reporting are measured at the state level, district by district.
Well, and my understanding is that how the department does it is they have a total dollar spent number. They can back out what they know is the pieces that are in the formula, and the number that's left over that's unaccounted for falls into this box. Is that the methodology
I don't want to comment precisely on how they do it, because I don't know exactly how they arrive at that number.
But you used the department's data. I did.
If we move to the chart on page 5, it'll give you a sense of the trends in these three major spending or revenue definitions. The bottom line, and this works a little bit better if these are color, but the bottom line is the change in formula operating revenue from 1991 to 2002. So you can see that's going from a little bit above $2 billion to a little bit above $3 billion.
Have you adjusted these at all?
No, these are nominal dollars, so they are what they are. They're not adjusted for inflation. And then you can see the gray line that falls in the middle are current expenditures. So that adds state grant monies, for example. There were some lottery funds that fell outside the formula operating revenues in the latter part of the 90s, some local monies, et cetera, and then also the federal money that would be used for current expenditures are added to that. And you can see
can I ask another question?
Yes.
Have some money that we put in as, we call it Senate Bill 622 money. Is that part of this also? It is?
Madam Chair, yes. Those dollars would have been outside the state school fund distribution formula, but they would have shown up as being spent by school districts. That's correct. Okay.
Please proceed.
Okay. And then finally, the top line, total expenditures would add capital outlays and debt service on interest for, again, the remodeling, building expansion, et cetera. And so you can see the three lines. I guess a trend that stands out is the slowest growing of the three lines are the formula operating revenues. And in essence, what happened in the late 1990s was somewhat faster growth. Both federal revenues that came into the state grew faster than formula operating revenues. And state grant monies that were outside of the formula operating revenues, and particularly those lottery funds in the late 1990s, were helping pick up that the current expenditures without changing the formula operating revenue. And then also some local monies were starting to appear in the middle to late 1990s as local districts either picked up the pace with foundation monies or local options, et cetera.
So again, here to just define the box that we're working in, we're talking about all the money that goes into the system, excluding the operations of the Department of Education.
Correct. We are everything that you're seeing here is consistent with the metric used by the Secretary of State's office. Now turning to page 6, so we've had three different candidates for spending. Now we have a number of different candidates for students as well, or student measures. Starting from left to right, fall enrollment is one way to count students, and that is a head count of students that are enrolled to be educated in public education at a particular point in time. Oregon uses October 1st. So you can see that figure in 1991 was a little bit more than 484,000. That grew to 551,000, increase of about 67,000 over that period of time. A second measure, which is roughly comparable but is measured somewhat differently, is the average daily resident membership. And rather than being counted at a precise point in time, average daily membership is counted over time. And so if, as students move in or move out over the course of the year, that number can differ somewhat from fall enrollment. As you can see, the numbers are not remarkably different. Certainly the change is almost identical over that period of time. Then the third column you'll see is average daily membership weighted, which is a definition that exists in this form only in the state of Oregon. It is the definition that is used to help distribute those formula operating revenues across districts, and it weights particular students differently. Many students are weighted only as one. It anchors off of this average daily resident membership. But then special education students are given a weight of 2 up to a certain point, and then students that are living in poverty or are in foster care or maybe kindergarten students, et cetera, are all given different weights. You can see that number increased by the largest amount. It's obviously the largest number since most of the weights are positive weights, not negative weights. So you get a bigger number in total. And the change is the largest as well at 114,000. Then finally is the notion of, we have the notion of average daily attendance, which like average daily resident membership is measured over time but only counts students who are actually in attendance on a particular day. So there you see that is lower than fall enrollment. Average resident resident membership, as one would expect. Also, its change over the course of that period of time was the smallest, at about 50,000. Now, as you can imagine, with three different spending figures and four different student figures, you can wreak havoc with one's understanding of how much Oregon spends per student.
Welcome to the legislature.
There you go. And this lies at the heart of the confusion that folks had when we started this study. So what we attempted to do here is put out six different figures by mixing and matching spending and student definitions. And so you can see on the far left, we have one that probably has a lot of currency in this building because it is one that drives spending debates. That's the formula operating revenue per ADMW. You can see that figure increased from a little bit more than $4,000 in 1991 to a little bit more than $5,000 in 2002. Those are not adjusted for inflation. Those are simply are what they are. Those are nominal dollars. Just so you have a sense of where that is headed, I believe in fiscal year 2003, that number is expected to drop a little bit to 4,988, according to the Department of Education. If we move all the way to the right and we take the total expenditures, which is obviously the largest spending figure, and we divide it by the smallest student count, which is the average daily attendance, we can come up with a number that's almost double the one that you saw on the left. And one could say that we are spending more than $10,000 per average daily attendee. Then finally, if we look in the middle, current expenditures per fall enrollee, that is a statistic that is most frequently used in cross-state comparisons because it both has a number of current expenditures that states tend to use fairly frequently and a fall enrollee definition that is fairly consistent across states as well. And that was the statistic that was used in the Oregonian article. So by 2002, we were up to about 7,856 on that particular figure. I guess what I would urge you to take away from this is all of these statistics are perfectly valid. And the only lesson to be learned here is to, as consumers of this information, is to make clear when people are coming to testify you which one of these statistics that they are using and make sure they aren't mixing and matching them as they make comparisons over time.
We spin our wheels a lot in this building on that very issue.
So then on page 8, we move to one more question that is fairly common, which is, has spending per student kept pace with inflation? And I just showed you 6 different ways of counting spending per student, but there's also a multiple different ways you could look at inflation. And that is why I didn't want to pass judgment on that and make the adjustments for you, but rather simply put on a piece of paper a number of different measures of inflation, and then also the percentage changes in the per student spending measures. So let's focus at the top of this chart to begin with on the inflation indices. The first of those 4 inflation indices is the Consumer Price Index for urban consumers, which is frequently used, a fairly common statistic that is used to measure inflation. You can see that between 1991 and 2001, and this is not an annual average change, it's obviously the total change over that period of time, that increased 30% between 1991 and 2001. If we move down to the next one, the most specific the federal statistics get on Oregon are to look at inflation in the Portland-Salem metropolitan area. And there you can see that outpaced the U.S. inflation some over that period of time, which probably comes to no one's surprise given what happened to housing prices in this area. And that increased 36.4%. Another statistic that is probably useful to consider when looking at inflation and whether school spending has kept pace with inflation would be average wages per job in Oregon. That is useful to look at in large part because education is such a labor-driven product. It's between 80 to 85% of school spending is related to salaries and benefits of labor. There's very little in the way of non-labor expenses on education relative to other sectors of the economy. If we look at Oregon average wages per job, that increased 54.4%. I want to stress in looking at that, that is a statewide average. That includes the Intels of the world in Washington County.
Well, I would ask you to consider, too, the time right. frame that you're looking at. In,
correct. Correct. And certainly does not represent the experience in all parts of Oregon, coastal areas and areas that do not benefit from to the same extent of the economic expansion of the 1990s would not have seen wage growth at that pace. Finally, the federal government, as part of that CPI, those first two statistics, also keeps track of a wage index on private elementary and high school tuition and fees. Now, that's a federal statistic. That's not an Oregon-specific statistic. But when they track that, private elementary and high school tuition and fees, they found that to have increased 88.4% over that period of time. So some fairly significant increases, at least on the private side of high school, elementary and high school spending. Now, if we drop to the bottom of the chart, this simply reports the percentage changes in those spending per student figures that we just reviewed. You can see that if we look at formula operating revenues, depending on which student measure we use, the AMDW or the ADMR, those both fall short of any of the inflation measures. The increase, if you're using the ADMW, is 20.6%. If you switch to ADMR, that increases to 27.6%. So when analysts come forward and say that formula operating revenues per student have not kept pace with inflation, that would be the point that they are making. With those two statistics. However, if we do look at the larger or more all-encompassing operations and maintenance figures that are represented by current expenditures, then we see in each of those current expenditure definitions, we're more in the neighborhood of 46 to 48% increase over the course of the decade. And, of course, that is driven in part because the federal funds were growing faster than operation than the state school funds, and there are also some local and state monies involved there as well. And then finally, the total expenditure per ADA increased 54.2%, which was at about the rate of average wages per job in Oregon.
Madam Chair, from your perspective and in your expertise, which one of these figures should we be making our decisions based on that would give us the clearest picture of what truly is happening?
Well, again, I would say they are all valid statistics. I believe that As a legislature goes forward, they have to keep in mind not only what they are providing through formula operating revenues, but also what other resources are available to the district. If, for example, the federal government passed a very large appropriation and increased its spending on education dramatically, then the legislature would certainly want to pay attention to that and keep that in mind as they were thinking about what states and localities' spendings would be as well. So the current expenditure figure is certainly a figure that that the legislature should pay attention to as it is considering the formula operating revenues as well.
Please continue. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Bates.
You have total expenditures per ADA, but am I missing total expenditures per ADM?
We could have created even more numbers, or but I didn't report that one here. I was simply, in the previous chart, trying to demonstrate the range, but one could certainly calculate that statistic.
Madam Chair, I'm not interested to see that figure. That's one that many of us think is significant.
Okay. So that concludes our findings on the first question, on spending per student, how it's defined, et cetera. On page 9, just the key findings, obviously spending per student can be defined in a number of ways, and findings on levels and growth can vary widely depending on the definition used. Moving on to the second part of the second question, and this is the question that sort of overlaps most with the Secretary of State's report, and therefore we might be able to be a little bit more brief on this discussion. But how does Oregon's spending per student compare to that of other states? The first thing you'd want to know before you even ask that question is, can you compare Oregon's spending per student to that of other states? Is the accounting comparable enough to accommodate that type of comparison? We did contact directly the person at the National Center on Education Statistics and pose that question to him. Are states reporting their spending in the same way? His answer was that if you had asked him that in the late 1980s, he would have advised that you don't compare between states because there was so much difference in the way that they were interpreting different accounting codes or what they different aspects of spending. But that between the late 1980s and throughout the early 1990s, that they had aggressively embarked on technical assistance to the best of their abilities, make sure that there was some comparability. But I believe there still are some ongoing debates, and as you discussed with the Secretary of State, states folks, clearly if you think of 198 districts in Oregon, and then multiply that by all the different states and all the different people that are doing these reports, there's always going to be room for error and different types of interpretations of the same instructions. So with that as a caveat, we'll now look at what we find when we look and when we compare Oregon to other places. On page 11, that compares our current expenditures per fall enrollee to the U.S. figure between the 1990-91 school year and the 2000-2001 school year. And there you sort of see a trend that Oregon was about 6 to 8% higher in the early 1990s, that dropped over the early part of the decade to the 96-97 school year when we were almost identical, within $3 of the U.S. average in 96-97, and then sort of picked up again, didn't reach the differences from the early 1990s, but then we're sort of bopping around at 3 to 5% higher by the 2001 school year. That's fueled in part by those lottery funds, in particular those state lottery funds helped elevate Oregon above the national average in those late 1990s. If we go to page 12, you can look at it in a different, sort of a different way, telling roughly the same story. This is looking at current expenditures as a percent of personal income, of total personal income, so all of the personal income in Oregon and these competing jurisdictions. You can see on the far left-hand side that Oregon's current expenditures as a percent of personal income were about 4.6% in 1990-91, fell to about 4.1% in 96-97, and there if we sort of leap to the other end of the table, you can see that we were just about on the U.S. average there in that year. And then we've bumped up a little bit to 4.2%. In 2000-2001. We do have higher current expenditures relative to personal income than California and Washington. We have throughout this period. Interestingly, Idaho, which is considered a low spending state, has spending per personal income that's roughly comparable with Oregon's, at least today it is. And so in large part, Idaho's low spending is could probably be characterized by the fact they just don't have a lot of personal income to spend. It's generally a less wealthy state in that respect. The let's see here. Now, if we move to page 13, we will take, and this is the analysis that the Secretary of State did as well. We're using the exact same database, but we're basically taking school spending and breaking it down into objects and functions. So you can take, and this is basically the same analysis that you saw on tables 1 through 3 in the Secretary of State's report. We are taking the full $7,149 per student current expenditures from the 99-2000 school year and cutting it up in two different ways. Just to be brief, our findings on page 14 are comparable or virtually identical to those of the Secretary of State, which is nice since we're using the same data. And the chart, the way that we have presented this is we are comparing Oregon to the comparison jurisdiction. So just to look at this chart, if you start off with the United States at the top on page 14, you can see that sort of light gray at the bottom of those bars are salaries per student, and there we spend less than the U.S. average. That darker bar at the top, or the second darker bar, are benefits per student. So there you can see that we spend more per student. We also spend a little bit more on purchased services per student, and a little bit less on supplies, tuition, and other items. You can see that that trend plays out relative to California, Washington, and Idaho, salaries being roughly comparable to California and Washington, but the benefits again stand out. If we look down at Idaho, clearly everything stands out because we spend quite a bit more per student than Idaho. Then if we move to page 15, basically the same story again as the Secretary of State. This takes the same total, 7,149, just cuts it up in a different way. So salaries and benefits, in essence, are buried in all of these numbers, but you're just sort of looking at the analysis in a different way. If we start at the bottom of the chart, total current expenditures per student, you can see we spent $238 more per student than the U.S. average in that year. Measured across all items, $834 more than California, $773 more than Washington, and $1,834 more than Idaho. I have highlighted the areas where you have some sort of consistency. You can see that instruction relative to California, Washington, and Idaho, a fair amount of our differences with those states stand out on the instructional side. But then that other support services, which is precisely the area that that you had lengthy discussions with the Secretary of State's staff, stand out here as well. So two reports, same findings. Page 16, just the key findings on the cross-state comparisons. During the 1990s, K through 12 spending fell as a share of total personal income, but still exceeds the U.S. average, at least by the end of the time that we measured it. Spending on benefits per student exceeds the U.S. average and levels in neighboring states, and salaries per student are roughly on par with California and Washington, but not on par with the U.S. average. Any questions before we proceed to the last question?
I have a much better understanding of the impact that this report had in Mr. Marshall's organization than I did before.
Finally, the third part, which I believe was quite useful, were the district level case studies. And the Oregon School Boards Association selected 16 school districts, recognizing that each of those school districts was facing different challenges over the course of the decade, were facing different perspectives on the equalization process that was taking place during the 1990s, and therefore would certainly have different comments on school funding and its adequacy over that period. In each of these districts, we both looked at Department of Education data, but we also interviewed three individuals in each of those districts, typically the superintendent, a school board member, and a business officer, if they were available. The 16 districts are listed on page 18 in that table, which also provides a lot of data that I will describe. But you can see we got a mix of larger districts. We tried to get districts from across the state, and basically trying to get districts that had different experiences over the course of the 1990s with respect to their funding. What this table does, and you might be confused by sort of the ordering here, but in essence the ordering of those districts is by the amount of local revenue that they had in 1991. So the higher they are on that table, the higher was their local revenue per student in 1991. So the hypothesis would be that districts at the top of the chart might have fared less favorably through equalization than districts at the bottom of the chart. What we're reporting here are three statistics. The three statistics are current expenditures per ADMR. So again, that's not ADMW and it's not fall enrollees, but current expenditures per ADMR. We chose that because it was easily found in those audited reports by the districts. And the change in that spending, and it's the total change over that period of time from 1991 to 2001. And what we have done is bolded the districts that had a change over that period of time that didn't keep pace with the Portland-Salem CPI. Now, that was an explicit decision, but you can go back and see what the U.S. CPI was 30 there, if you consider that a more appropriate measure. But in any event, what we found, as you can see on current expenditures per ADMR, that four of those 16 districts had the current expenditures per ADMR failed to keep pace with that Portland-Salem CPI over the decade. The districts at the bottom of the chart, you can see the growth was a little bit faster than the districts at the top of the chart, though not terribly dramatically so.
Could you give the members of the committee what you postulated were the reasons for this being this way? Did you come up with any conclusions?
The district at the bottom of the chart, again, were the districts that in 1991 had the lowest local revenue per student. So by definition, we would have hypothesized would have benefited the most from the equalization process.
So this ranking then would have been a function of
conditions in 1991 to begin with. And so you can see that the four districts that failed to keep pace with the Portland CPI are toward the top of the chart. Sort of catching your eye is that Neocony, which is a very unique district that has a lot of local revenues, they fared reasonably well relatively well over the course of that decade, but they have a very peculiar funding condition there.
Clear on this. So this included the income from timber?
Correct.
Federal and local?
Yes.
When you talk the timber taxes, when you talk about the amount of local contribution?
Yes, back in 1991.
Okay.
And so again, the generally the districts at the top of the list had current expenditures per ADMR grow a little bit more slowly, than the districts at the bottom. The next two columns break out two components of those current expenditures to look at spending on regular education instruction, which is a part of instructional expenditures, and special education instruction, which is another component of instructional expenditures. And those are accounting terms. There are actually parts of the audited statistics that are put forward by those districts that break them out into those categories. But as you can see, if we look at the middle column, regular education instruction, which would be your regular mainstream math, writing, reading, etc., that 10 districts had increases in regular education instruction that failed to keep pace with the Portland-Salem CPI. The remaining six exceeded the Portland CPI, but not by a lot. Remember, that was 36 point something percent, and all of those are roughly in that category. Then if we look at special education instruction per MDR ADMR, and I want to stress here that this is not only special education limited to, it is not limited to students with physical and mental disabilities, but also includes at-risk students or students at risk of dropping out. It includes ESL and the broader definition of special education. You can see that the increases there were much more robust over that period of time. And that is consistent with all of the interviews that we had with administrators, superintendents, and business office individuals in those districts, that they, over the course of that decade, were spending increasing amounts of their budgets on probably what amounted to 15 to 20% of their students as they expanded ESL offerings. For example, in Salem at the beginning of the decade, there may have been a couple of ESL centers where students in need of those services would be located for parts of the day. Now ESL is offered in most of the school district or most of the buildings throughout the district. But also some increases in spending on students with mental and physical disabilities. Administrators said that over the course of the decade, there were sort of two factors that drove that. One was sort of the increasing demand by parents with those students as they better understood their sort of the federal law on that and the services that were due their children as outlined in federal law. That sort of combined with the threat of litigation if those services weren't provided. So a lot of superintendents talking about walking the fine line of litigation if those services weren't provided.
I have a question. As part of the study, did you break out the categories that the spending went into, and is that why you're saying ESL was the premier area that the money went into?
If I said that, I'm apologize for having said that. I did not say ESL was the premier area. ESL is one of the categories that falls into this into our definition of special education instruction. There is a chart in the main report that I can point you to that breaks out the various categories. I don't know if you have the main report.
Where are you at in the main report?
On page 2-11. Is there a chart there that has a bar graph on it?
Bar graph, yeah.
Correct. And so this is, these are statewide statistics, sort of speaking on the same topic. But here, and I want to we had to present this, you know, in the way that the Department of Education's data allowed us to present it. But this is the way that we did present it. You can see that at the top of that bar, this is the average annual growth rate in spending per ADMR for these various categories. So there you can see that instruction for regular programs growing, I believe that's a little bit more than 3% a year, right at about in the rate of inflation. Now, if we come down we have four bars in the middle. The bar at the top is instruction for special programs, which is what I was just describing on this district-by-district basis. There you can see that it, across all the categories that I'm about to describe, if you took the average or the weighted average of that, that was growing at about 14% a year across the state, spending on special programs in total. Within that was the next bar down, special programs for students with mental or physical disabilities. There you can see that one is growing at about the same rate as the average, 14% a year. Instructional spending for ESL and early intervention growing at about 9% a year over that period. Then you can see a large increase.
Early intervention, is that early intervention related to ESL, or is that early intervention in the sense that we think of children with disabilities and special needs?
That is not directly tied to ESL. It's simply that the way that the accounting information was presented, I couldn't disentangle it from ESL.
Another clarifying question, if I could. The department does have a program called Early Intervention in its grant and aid program unit, and I just wanted to clarify that this is early intervention as it pertains to K-12, though, correct?
Correct.
Not that separate program, which you will hear about in a few weeks.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, alternative education, is that like IEPs? What are we talking about here?
Not IEPs. That would be students classified at risk of dropout prevention programs and the like. That has a very dramatic looking bar, growing at more than 40% a year over that period. But what's somewhat deceiving about that is that it's starting at a very small number, and those figures are in the text just above that. So it doesn't play a large role in the larger number or the larger overall bar. But nonetheless, spending increased significantly on that over the course of the decade.
We are quickly running into a time problem.
Yes.
Okay. Chair, could I ask one question back on page 18? I'm really struck by the wide variance between the districts on that chart. Did anything come out of your study that would indicate a point on there?
No, and that would probably be an area that if the legislature, the Secretary of State's auditors were interested in pursuing, it's certainly an area that that those superintendents and budget officers, et cetera, should share information on and understand what is driving those rates in different districts. Certainly, some has to do with demographics in some districts. The in-migration of students with language needs was higher than in other districts.
And I might also add, Madam Chair, Senator Messerly, it wasn't until the latter part of the decade of the 90s that we moved towards the database initiative, the uniform chart of accounts, and work by the Department of Education to assure more uniform accounting by school districts, that is, putting the appropriate expenditures in the right box so there's more comparability.
So very quickly to summarize, what happens if you go on that chart on page 18, in those districts where you see regular education instruction growing at less than the rate of inflation, what the superintendents, budget officers, et cetera, were conveying to us was lost in the process. If they couldn't keep pace with inflation, typically that meant some type of service reduction. And those service reductions most frequently were in the areas of music and languages, in sports and outdoor school programs, et cetera. a couple of additional overall findings. Caps on health insurance helped keep benefit growth in check in many of the districts that we spoke with over that period. And also the districts had yet to experience a strong growth in the PERS contributions, so the big uptick in PERS is yet to be seen. And it's not shown in these statistics. So the overall conclusions. On page 20, a single statewide spending estimate is going to miss some very important complexities. Obviously, the equalization process treated districts differently over the course of the 1990s, and that has to be paid attention to. And then it also fails to show that picture of regular versus special education and in essence, an implementation of federal law that took place during the 1990s. Second point, Oregon spending per student trended toward the U.S. average but remained above it in 2001. Moving to page 21, Oregon spending per student on employee benefits is above the national average in levels in neighboring states. And Oregon also shows a higher spending per student on purchased services and those other support services that were also highlighted by the Secretary of State's office.
Thank you. Colleagues, we have yet to do DAS's overview of the budget. So if there are no burning questions, final comments, parting shots, we will very much thank these people for bringing this very interesting information before the committee. Thank you. Ms. Ames, you're up.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Linda Ames with Department of Administrative Services. And after six long hours of testimony, you're going to know most of this, so I'm going to be able to do it very quickly. It's this little handout, which we handed out yesterday, but we do have a few extra copies back there if anyone has failed to find it again. Page 2, the big spreadsheet with all the numbers for the state school funds. I just want to point out a couple things. In the governor's budget, you see we still have $73.8 million of MUPL funding. That is all the MUPL funding we expect in 0305. It's also the end of MUPL, except for I think we're saying there may be a couple million dollars left in 0507. The other thing I wanted to point out is the 0103 numbers through fifth special session. This is a technical look at the state school fund. This is appropriations in law. So, for instance, the $3.8 billion here does not include resources that may be accrued. It does not include the administrative rule reductions. This is what the appropriations are in law for funding in 0103. I might point out, we in our budget presentations are showing things through fifth special session, and the reason for that is those cuts are all rolled up. Anything after that has not been rolled into 0305. However, for the state school fund, there were no net changes to funding as a result of the sixth special session. There were some small shifts between types of funds. Page 3, I'm just trying to give you a sense here where the state school fund fits within the statewide budget for general funds and lottery, 44%. And the other thing that's kind of interesting here is if you look at all of education, which, of course, you will be doing in the next few weeks, it's 59% of the state budget.
And, again, this is based on the governor's balanced budget.
Right. And just general fund and lottery. But page 4, a sense of where the state school fund fits within the Department of Education's total budget. It is most of the budget here. You have a few more dollars in grant and aid that, of course, is also passed through dollars out to school districts and ESDs and some other local providers, and then relatively small pieces of funding in operations and debt service. Page 4 shows the different fund types in the governor's budget. That's just the state side. But then on, that's 5. On page 6, then you get a look at the different funds in both the state and the local resources and a sense of magnitude. So besides the state funds, you have property taxes making up 29% of the total funding that goes. This is the funding that we base the budget building on, state plus local funds. This is also the funding that goes through the equalization formula process.
And again, just to clarify, what I call the mystery money, the money that kind of falls out at the end of the computation, is that the 2% that's other local revenues, or is that in here?
Madam Chair, the other local revenues are like the timber money and the common school fund money. It does not include private donations and those.
It's outside the formula that comes to the district.
It does not.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, it also wouldn't include the federal funds.
That's a good
right.
point.
And in the agency's budget, both in operations and in grant and aid, you will see there's another $700 million in federal funds that will go out to school districts and other providers in 0305. Page 7, about 5% of the state and local resources go to ESDs, next biennium. We are in the process of phasing in the ESDs up to that 5% level. Page 8, just a historical perspective, you really see the effect of Measure 5 and Measure 50 increasing the school funding as a percent of state resources. The other point is, within a very limited resources level here, the governor's budget does give some priority to K-12. It is slightly higher percent than it's been the last few biennia. Okay, page 9, the next three slides try to give you a sense of the 0103 budget and what's happening in order to understand then how we build the 0305. I mainly wanted to focus here on the third column. Now, these numbers are more of a sense of resources. So it's through the sixth special session. It does include the accrued resources here. And there's really two points. One is that top white piece on that bar that is other funds, and that was one-time funding used to keep schools from incurring bigger cuts during the current biennium. Those aren't there next time, and so those are filled in with general fund in the 0305 budget.
So other funds in this case were the money that was taken out of the rainy day fund and those kinds of moves that we made in the interim?
Madam Chair, exactly. And in fact, a little later I have a chart that shows the different pieces. But what you'll see is, while if you look at the percentage increase between the sixth special session level and the governor's budget, state school fund is up 3%. And again, that's if you include the accrued resources in the current biennium. But general fund specifically is up 18%. And I know sometimes you hear that out there and you're going, well, that can't be. School funding hasn't grown 18%, but that's what happened. This lists out the various reductions in 0103. You've seen this all before. I did want to mention on the MUPL shortfall, we know we have an $11.5 million shortfall in the MUPL funding to the state this biennium. That's for sure. The only question that remains is how it is allocated among the three players that receive that funding, which is the State School Fund, OHSU, and the Oregon Rural Health Association. Short of specific legislation, DAS believes that their only alternative will be to proportion that amongst the three evenly proportioned. That's where the $8 million for state school fund comes. Page 11 then for 0103 shows the different fund types and how they shifted around. It also helps you to understand where all the dynamics were. If you look over on the column most to the right, you see you have a total general fund reduction of $979 million, so almost $1 billion, and $468 million of that really was shifted from general fund to some other fund source, including the Education Stability Fund, increased MUPL funding, and the tobacco funding, although we eventually just dumped the tobacco money into the general fund. So in this chart, it ends up showing as general fund. $18 million of the cut was a fund shift to local revenues, so the schools, we hope, will get more common school fund money. And $211 was the shift, or the accrued resources that are cut out of 0103, but they will be allowed to use some 0305 revenue for those expenditures. It leaves you at a $282 million real reduction in resources. What are we doing? Okay. Page... 1 minute. Page 12 then gives the high-level view of the governor's budget. All cuts through Special Session 5 were rolled up. They were all in the second year of the current biennium, and that cut level then was included in each of the years in 0305. So essentially you've doubled the cut amount, and you're reducing the budget about $500 million as a result of those cuts during 0103. In addition, the governor's budget cuts another $550 million to eliminate COLAs, STEPs, all increases in health benefits, and all other inflation. What the governor's budget then does include is student growth, funding for more students, and the PERS increase where we thought we would be a year ago or so. Then the governor does add back $1 million with his mentioning that his priority is to keep school days. The one other thing that's in the governor's budget that is so little it gets missed is last session you passed a local option equalization grant program that will give some state matching funds to school districts that have relatively low property wealth. So if they can pass a local option levy, the school will give them some additional funding to bring them up to what the 75th percentile district could have earned. This budget does contain $550,000 for those matching grants, which is what we estimate we'll need to cover the existing districts that are getting those, plus a little cushion in case we have one pass in May. Current districts receiving those grants is Pendleton, Colton, Oakland, and starting next year, Seaside. So in spite of this incentive, districts have found it very hard to pass local option levies, especially poorer districts. The next couple slides just briefly talk about the process that we use for developing the governor's budget. A group called the School Revenue Forecast Committee has the task of estimating funding necessary to maintain the current program level. That started by executive order back in 99, so this is the second biennium we've used that process. And over that period, we've continued to refine the data and the methodology we use to estimate resource need. And I just want to emphasize the purpose of this group is really a technical one, to lay out data, to lay out methodology and issues, to understand what it takes to fund schools at their current program level, not any policy discussions or decisions about where we would like to fund them. Okay. 14 talks a little bit more then about the pieces that we've done through that group. With this, the major improvement in the data and methodology this biennium has been in our ability to estimate personal services costs more accurately and in a lot more detail, in particular being able to account not only for the increases in costs, but the savings that you get when you have retirements and you have new teachers coming in at a lower salary level than the teachers that are retiring. So really the bottom line on a sort of current program is with no cuts, we would have been about at $6 billion for schools for the state. With the cuts through Special Session 5 at about $5.5 billion, and then the governor's budget at just slightly over $5 billion. And the next charts really just give you a couple more looks at that same picture of the governor's budget. On page 15, you will notice I have split out some of the different pieces of cuts so that if you want to say, you know, what if we could fund health benefits but not this, you know, what sort of general levels of funding. And I think I'll stop there for any questions. I'm happy to answer questions afterwards, too, if people need to go.
I don't see any questions or comments, but I thank you for hanging in there till the end of this with us. Ms. McGlash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to add one piece of information. Linda talked about the School Revenue Forecast Committee using more data, including the teacher salary data. And one of the things that's a change from past calculations is in the past, the student growth factor tended to mirror the growth in the ADMR, or the average daily membership of resident students. And this last go-around with the School Revenue Forecast Committee, there was some analysis done on the growth in the specific weights that are assigned to students under the formula statutes. And as a result of using the growth in the weighted number of students, you come up with a higher growth factor than you would have under ADMR. In fact, it's about double. And, of course, using a higher growth factor, it does drive up the total budget. And I just wanted to bring that to your attention. There's general acknowledgement that the weights are there because they're designed to reflect the higher cost of serving certain categories of students. But it's my understanding that in the revenue committee, where they deal with the distribution formula, most of the discussions have kind of centered around how the weights can have the effect of dividing up total funding rather than driving it. But in this case, looking at the weighted student growth actually does drive up the funding, and that's just kind of something for you to consider as a policy choice.
Thank you.
That's an interesting piece of information. Thank you for giving us that. Further comments, questions? What I'll do then is recess the public hearing on House Bill 5016. And before I recess this committee, I'll remind the members that we have public testimony tonight. We'll be back in Hearing Room F, and we're scheduled to begin again at 6 p.m., and we will go until 8 p.m. And with that, I will recess this committee. We'll reconvene at 6 p.m. this evening.